And so I think Bruce really exemplifies many of the aims and qualities that we've sought in this conference. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome him to present his keynote address entitled Ubiquitous Surveillance and Security. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you and good morning. Thanks for getting out of bed. I appreciate it. I want to talk for the next 45 minutes about the relationship between data and power and how the internet affects that. You know, who gains power, who loses power, what the effects are, and then think about how to fix what I think is broken. I mean, it's a common phrase that information is power. I think that's a little simplified. I mean, really, it's differential information that's power, right? Having more information than somebody else. And you know, without getting into the philosophical details, I mean, I think of data as unprocessed information, right? And that more data is a potential for more power. Right, in a lot of different things, right? In negotiations, in persuasion, in control. And this is true for governments, for corporations, for individuals, for everybody. And that's kind of what I want to look at. The internet fundamentally changes our access to information. I mean, it renders dinner table conversations obsolete in some cases. Right? You know, facts are no longer things we discuss. We just look them up. This makes us all more powerful, right? So in some ways, nothing changes, but of course, that's not the whole story, right? There's a lot more information out there, and those who have access to even more of it have even more power. And this kind of at a meta level explains why everyone is trying to collect their information, right? And why, you know, why there's so much attempts to control us. And the way I think of this, I mean, again, being very broad, is that data is basically a byproduct of the information society. And everything we do on a computer produces a transaction record. Browsing the internet, making a phone call, paying for something, anything other than cash, right? A medical device. I mean, I woke up this morning and I used an Uber to get here, generating data. I bought breakfast with a credit card generating data. I had my cell phone with me the whole time. Oh, and I turned on my computer. And I probably was photographed by any number of a dozen security cameras here and there, right? All producing data about me. Right? Data is a byproduct of our information society socialization. I had a very nice conversation with my wife this morning. We had it over IM. Right? And data was produced about that conversation. I mean, not just that we had it, but actually the contents. Right, so phone calls, emails, text messages, Facebook chatter, all produces data. This data is increasingly stored and increasingly searchable. And if there's a change, that's what's it. Right, this is Moore's law. Data storage drops to free, data processing drops to free, and the stuff we used to throw away, we now save. Right, this is the promise of big data. This is why everyone's building large data centers. You know, it's funny. I was thinking that thinking about my email, and I went and checked. Before 2006, I sorted all my mail. I had hundreds of email boxes, and I would carefully sort mail into where they belong by person, by topic, by time. 2006, I stopped. I didn't have like one email box. Because for me, for email in 2006, search became cheaper than sort. Right? It was easier to save everything and look for it later than to figure out what to save. Right? You know, you might have a different experience with email, but that line has been crossed with pretty much all of our data. Right? Storage is so cheap, search is so easy. So why bother figuring it out? And with that switch, the nature of our relationship with data changed, right? We used to save data for historical reasons, right? To remember what we said or did. I mean, I call my email my offline brain. It's a record of everything I did. So we stored data to recall stuff. We stored data to verify our actions to some third party, right? Think of our tax records. We stored things to let future generations know what we were doing. And those are all historical reasons. Now with all this data, it more likely drives future decision making. Right? We store data to decide things about the future. Right? This again is the promise of big data. That we'll be able to make better decisions because of all of our data. Right? Not just recall the past, but drive the future. Now this data is largely surveillance data. And when Edward Snowden first started revealing the extent of NSA surveillance, that was one of the common refrains you heard from the president, from members of Congress, that it's only metadata. And the president said something like, no one is listening to your phone calls. Now, metadata is fundamentally surveillance data. I mean, as computer scientists, metadata is a weird thing because one program's metadata is another program's data. But at a much more social sense, metadata is data that the system needs to operate. Right? So it's not the contents of your phone call, but all the routing information and the billing information. That's basic surveillance data. And the way I think of it, I mean, imagine I hired a private detective to spy on this guy. And so the detective would put a bug in his home, in his car, in his office, and I'd get a report, right? I'd get a report of the conversations he had. Right? That's the data. That's what we're told isn't being collected, I guess, on Americans. If you're not an American, all bets are off. But imagine I hired a detective to put him under surveillance. And I'd get a different report. A report of where he went, who he spoke to, what he purchased, what he read, what he did. That's all metadata. Right? Metadata is surveillance data. It's in a lot of ways a lot more important than conversation content. Right? It tracks our relationships, our associations, what we're interested in, who's important to us. Right? Metadata reveals who we are. And as an added bonus, it's much easier to store, to search, and to analyze. So today, we are living in the golden age of surveillance. And it's an interesting kind of surveillance. Right? It's incidental. It's a side effect of all the computerized services we use. It's covert. We don't see it happening. I mean, there are hundreds of internet trackers that are tracking us on the internet. We don't see any of them. It's not like people are peeking behind curtains and looking at us. We'd notice that. Right? We don't see most of the cameras. It's hard to opt out of. I mean, you cannot not use a credit card. I mean, you can't not have an email address. I mean, I don't use Gmail. I mean, I don't want Google having copies of all my mail. But last time I checked, Google has a third of my mail because you all use Gmail. And it's ubiquitous. It's happening to all of us everywhere because everything is being computerized. And ubiquitous surveillance is fundamentally different. You know, we just had a Supreme Court ruling in the United States earlier this week about the collecting of data on someone's cell phone at a police stop. And if you read the ruling, Judge Roberts makes a very interesting point that even though it's the same as collecting anything that's in your pocket, which is normal practice, the phone is different. And a difference of scale means a difference of kind. Right? Ubiquitous surveillance isn't follow that car, which we've all seen on cop shows. It's follow every car. And when you can follow every car, you can do different things. Right? You can do surveillance backwards in time. Tell me where that car was last month. You can do what the NSA calls hop searches. And they talk about this, well, We know about this from Snowden documents on metadata surveillance for phone calls. And it, when they're looking at who's calling who, they have a person of interest, look at who they're calling. Right? So they go three hops away from the individual. Or something you couldn't possibly do if you're following one car. Or something we're still trying to figure out what the NSA is doing with what they call about searches, which are other selectors than names. So selecting on topics or locations. And again, you need the database of surveilling everybody to make that work. Or finding people that fit certain surveillance characteristics. Now, for example, you know that you're interested in three date-time location combinations. Right? Can you search the database and look for anybody who's been at those three points of space-time? Right? Or flagging something as interesting based on some predefined criteria or some criteria that's not even predefined. Now, these are the sorts of things you can do when you have all the data. Now, I'll give a couple of examples from cell phone location data. We know from NSA documents. One is, and this is actually kind of clever, they will search the database and look for phones that get turned off. When they find a phone that gets turned off, they look for other phones that are turned off around the same time nearby that also get turned on around the same time nearby elsewhere. And if you think about it, that's looking for secret meetings. Or they'll look for phones that get turned off permanently and then phones that get turned on permanently afterwards with similar calling patterns. So they're trying to chain burner phones. Again, you need all the data to do this. So even including the NSA, most of this data is being collected by corporations. And I think this is something that we don't see a lot of in the discussions of the NSA. It's surveillance is the business model of the internet. We build systems that spy on people in exchange for services. You know, initially we did this for efficiency reasons. The internet appears for commercial purposes, mid-90s. There's no obvious way to charge anybody. Credit card companies hadn't yet figured out very cheap charges. And people expected the internet to be free. So the only place there was to exact money was advertising. There was already a huge data collection industry in credit reporting and direct marketing, which was able to flow right in. And now we have, you know, the major sites of the internet make their money by spying on you. Right, this is Facebook, this is Google, New York Times, this is everybody. Because you always have to remember, you're not the customer, you're the product. And actually, even when you are the customer, you're also the product. Because now we're seeing, on cell phones especially, apps that charge $1 a month, $2 a month, $1 permanently. These apps don't take your money and then not spy on you. They take your money and then they spy on you. Right? And the forces here are, I think, are free and convenient. That's why people are doing this. The data, of course, is collected, you know why, for psychological manipulation. You know, usually called advertising, which is the other business model of the internet, right? Propaganda. And in these things, more data is more power, right? Personalized ads, personalized offers, personalized psychological manipulation. And we know a lot of this is going on. The types of offers you see depend on your browsing history, which computer you use, time of day, your identity. This kind of personalized advertising happens a lot. And corporations know an amazing amount about us. You know, our cell phones is the single most invasive surveillance device ever invented. And if you think about it, it reveals where you live, where you work, who you spend time with during the day and at night, who you talk to, what you do, right? And I used to say that Google knows more about me than my wife does, but that's true, certainly, but it's also, it doesn't go far enough. Google knows more about me than I do. right? Because Google remembers everything, and I don't. And Google knows what kind of porn all of you like, which is creepy. But it's the system we've built. Right? And government surveillance largely piggybacks on all these same capabilities. Right? The NSA uses internet cookies, logins, cell phone location data. They use everything. Right? And this piggybacking, this alliance, lets governments get away with a level of surveillance we would never allow them otherwise. Right? The government said, you must carry a tracking device with you 24/7. We would never allow it. Yet we happily carry our cell phones. Right? Or if the FBI said, whenever you make a new friend, you must inform us. Right? But instead, you inform Facebook. Right? If the police said, you must leave a copy of all your correspondence with local police office. Right? We'd never do it, but we leave it with Google. Right? We would never agree to government demands to know all of our porn habits. Right? We never would. But we provide this data willingly daily to corporations. So government collection is largely because of fear, right? Depending on your country. Right? In the U.S., it's fear of terrorists, fear of criminals. You go to China, it'll be fear of the people. But, I mean, there is this fear that drives collection, and again, data is power. Now, what's interesting, in the past couple of decades, the nature of collection has changed. I mean, going back to the NSA, the NSA changed their model at about the same time we changed our relationship with all this data, producing all this data exhaust. And I think it's important to go back and look at the NSA's mission and their history for a little bit. Right? NSA, born out of the Cold War, right? And at that time, a voyeuristic interest in the Soviet Union was normal. Right? We collected a lot of data, some of it useful, a lot of it not. Right, and there's this notion of tactical facts versus strategic ideas or secrets versus mysteries. Right? It's a lot easier to learn about the speed of the new Soviet battle tank than to figure out, you know, what is Khrushchev thinking? Or even now, what is Putin thinking? You know, that kind of surveillance faded when the Cold War ended. And a lot of less of it was going on, and I think the NSA budgets reflected that. That got a new lease on life with the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The President of the United States gave the intelligence community an impossible mission, and that mission was never again. Right? Completely ridiculous. But if you think about it, the only possible way of preventing something from ever happening is to know everything that does happen. Right, so that giant eye of the NSA was turned inward on ourselves, outward on the world. And that changed the nature of the NSA's collection. I mean, because formerly, the collection targets were foreign governments. Nation-on-nation espionage, something as old as nations. This new NSA mission is nation-on-population surveillance. Because right, you've got an enemy that is anyone, anywhere. So you have to watch everyone, everywhere. So we move from espionage to surveillance, from targeted surveillance to ubiquitous surveillance. At around the same time, the nature of communications changed. Back to the Cold War, communications were isolated by communication circuits. If you wanted to spy in the Soviet military, you listened to Soviet military communications channels. And they were separate. That you would never hear American citizens chatting on Soviet military communications networks. That changed. Right? Now, everyone is using the same network. Right? That IM conversation with my wife this morning could have very easily flowed through Europe. Why? Because that's the way the net works, right? It looks for the best routing regardless of geography. So you can't isolate communications based on the physicality of where the bits are going. Right? We have one global communications infrastructure. which is why it's now very hard for the NSA not to spy on Americans, even if it wants to, even if it doesn't want to, because we're all using the same communications channels. We're all using the same protocols and the same networks, the same everything. So the power of companies is also increasing in information. And there's sort of two other trends I want to mention in computing, which are more recent trends that are really changing the nature of us and data and companies that have it. And the first is the rise of cloud computing. Traditionally, our data was physically near us. It was on our computers, in our homes, in our offices. And U.S. law protecting privacy has spheres of physicality. Things that are near us get more protections because they're perceived to be more intimate. Our homes, our cars, our persons. The search rules are different than the stuff I have in the storage locker across town. But data has changed. All of our data is now in the storage locker across town. Right? Our emails, photos, calendars, address book, messages, documents, they're not on our computers. They're on servers belonging to Google, Apple, Microsoft, and everybody else. Might not be true for you guys, but it's true for everybody else. You know, you talk to a young person today, and they actually don't really get where their computer ends and the internet begins, because the difference is irrelevant now. Right? So the rules have changed. And secondly, we're accessing our data on devices that we have much less control over. Think of iPhones, iPads, Android phones, Chromebooks. The old paradigm was you'd buy a computer, you'd take it home, and you had absolute control over it. What software you could install, how it worked, what you can do. That is not true on an iPhone. Every piece of software on an iPhone has been approved for sale by Apple, which is why certain types of applications are not available for your iPhone. And you cannot install them. I mean, you could hack it and jailbreak it, and leaving that aside, there's a much greater control because that device is online all the time. Now, of course, companies are doing this because they want the revenue stream. I mean, your Kindle, you can't even control when a software update happens. You can't control if Amazon decides to delete a book off your Kindle. You have basically no control over it. It's almost back to the days of dumb terminals. I mean, this is being done for business reasons. And actually, if you look at the new computer OSs, Windows 8, Apple's Mountain Lion and Yosemite, right, both of them are moving in that same direction. There's a company store, and you're really pressured to do everything through that single interface. So the result is actual control, right? Control of what we can see, what we can use, what we can do. And there's a consolidation of power going on. I mean, I think of it as the public-private surveillance partnership. There's a lot of back and forth between governments and corporations in surveillance. The governments leverage corporate collection. We talked a bit about that, both surreptitiously and by asking. We see examples of that in all countries. Right? I mean, it works the other ways too. Corporations will mine government databases. Lots of places in the United States where license plate data is sold to corporations. Stuff like that happens in the UK too. Recently, there was a big issue where the government was going to sell health data until somebody noticed and put a stop to it. A lot of moving back and forth of data. In the US, we see a lot of corporations hiding behind government secrecy laws. A lot of things that used to be public are now not being made public because of the terrorists. And it's things like environmental safety data. There are people in writing about this calling it the security industrial complex, right? This massive amount of private corporations supporting government surveillance. I mean, lots of surveillance technology providers. If you were paying attention this past week, both Citizen Lab in Toronto and Kaspersky, a Russian antivirus company, published reports on a piece of malware called RCS, Remote Control Systems, developed by a company called Hacking Team in Italy, and they sell this to governments. And it's pretty amazing stuff. The software allows the person who buys it to hack, I think it's all major operating systems, and then the new revelations about their attacks against mobile, against iOS, against Android, against Windows Mobile, and against BlackBerry, allowing them to remotely take over your phone, get all the data off it, turn the microphone on when you're making a call, when you're not making a call, have the camera snap pictures, and then send all that back. And this is for sale to governments. Hacking Team's website says they only sell to good governments, but we have evidence of it being used in Saudi Arabia, in Kazakhstan, in Ethiopia, in places you wouldn't normally put on the list of good governments. Right, so there's a lot that's going on. There are a lot of cyber weapons arms manufacturers. There have been some breaks in this partnership. Right? Since Snowden in the United States, we're seeing especially internet companies pushing back. Right? Telephone companies have had decades of history of cooperating with NSA. You know, so when the NSA goes to AT&T in year 2002 or so, and says, we want to spy on the entire internet, and AT&T will say, great, put your stuff in that closet over there, lock the door, don't tell anybody. Google doesn't have that level of familiarity, and companies like Google and Facebook and Apple, LinkedIn, Yahoo, are pushing back once more, much more against surveillance. Some have tried to fight it in court. Some have tried to fight the gag orders. Some just demand payments to do it. We are seeing more examples of this. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot more forceful demands from government to make systems open to surveillance. Now, we know, for example, that the government forced Microsoft to make some changes in how Skype works to make it easier to perform surveillance. We don't know the details of them. We know they happened. Now, we know that the government tried to get the master encryption key from a email provider called Lavabit. Lavabit was a secure email provider that had a couple hundred thousand users, which was fine, except one of them was named Edward Snowden, which turned out to be bad. And the FBI went to Lavabit and said, we want to read this person's email. Lavabit said, well, we don't have the system to do that. Here's explaining how. FBI went back and said, well, you can give us the entire master key to every one of your users, and that would do it. Lavabit went to the court and said, they can't possibly be serious. That's crazy. Court said, do it. Lavabit responded by producing the master key printed out in 3-point type. Court said, ha-ha, not funny. And Lavabit closed down at that point. You know, an interesting story, the only reason we know about it is that Lars Levinson ran Lavabit. He's a singular person, and he could do this kind of thing. Right? He can perform a moral act in the face of a court order. Right? Something Google could never do. Right? There is no scenario where Google says, well, I'll shut Gmail down rather than comply. Right? Never in a gazillion years would that happen. So we don't know where this is happening elsewhere. It's unlikely this is the only case, but it's the only one we know about. So what's going on here? As this advances, I think we're going to see more surveillance. You know, there is a war against general purpose computing that's coming. You know, we saw it in the copyright wars. The notion that people have general purpose computers that can do anything is very disturbing to lots of powerful corporations. In the copyright wars, it was computers that could play or make copies of music, movies, videos, books that they hadn't paid for. And lots of pressure to add physical security. Lots of reasons why this doesn't work, open source software, computers can do anything. We saw lots of draconian laws to try to enforce copyright, and a lot of them enforced by surveillance. I mean, I'll sort of spare you the history of the copyright wars, but think of that as a precursor to a lot of things that are coming. Cory Doctorow writes about this. 3D printers will make copyright wars look like child's play. Right? And it's the same thing, right? I mean, I need a 3D printer that will print anything except this list of prohibited objects. But that list of objects will include things like guns, anatomically correct interchangeable Barbie torsos, There are places in this country where sex toys are illegal. So it's copyright items, it's dangerous items, it's all the it's really big deal things. And lawmakers will demand that they be, you know, not permitted to print those things. You know, we'll get that same thing with bioprinters, but it'll be viruses. Like physical viruses, not computer viruses, real ones that kill people. You'll see that same thing in self-driving cars. Right? The car has to not run any piece of software, because then you can get, you know, I don't know, like Knight Rider or something. Right? It only has to run this approved list. Or software-defined radio. Right now, we have radio spectrum security by the fact that the physical tuner doesn't work on prohibited frequencies. That just fails in the world of software-defined radio. So we're going to see a lot more surveillance, a lot more pushes to monitor everybody from governments, you know, because of these fears. And I think that's coming in very dangerous. All right, so what do we do here? And I'm writing a book on this, so I've been thinking about solutions and ways to move forward. It's actually very hard. I have principles that I think about. Right? The first one is security and privacy. That the notion of security versus privacy makes fundamentally no sense. That privacy is part of security. That we need both. We need to figure out how to get both. The second is sort of, I think, the generic framework for all solutions is transparency, oversight, and accountability. That the way we deal with giving entities power over us is being able to know what they're doing, right? To have oversight over what they're doing, to give them to have them be accountable for what they're doing. And a lot of the failures here, you know, both on the government secrecy side and in the corporate side, are failures of transparency, oversight, and accountability. These are actually things markets will not fix in many cases. Right? And certainly in government surveillance, knowing what's going on, deciding whether it's the right thing to do, is the way forward. So in general, we need more openness over secrecy. That when we have to decide, we should err on the side of openness. You know, we should look to reduce power imbalances. That a lot of the abuses come from inherent power imbalances. Right? Assume imperfections in our systems. Design systems for resilience. And lastly, the notion of that there's only one network here, right? One world, one network, one answer. That you know, I mean, I'll see this sort of written in terms of us versus them. Right? You know, we have to spy because if we don't, the Chinese will. You know, and that's very much of an arms race argument, right? It's us versus them. And it shouldn't be them, so it might as well be us. That doesn't work when it's all or nothing. We're not trying to decide whether the U.S. gets to spy or China gets to spy. It's either does everyone get to spy or does nobody get to spy. I mean, the vulnerabilities we have in our systems enable surveillance by anybody. We make our systems secure. We are secure from everybody's surveillance. And that's a really important reframing. There's a lot of details here. I could think of political solutions. I could think of legal solutions, technical solutions. I mean, all of which, you know, do pieces. A nice patchwork solution you can design. But really, in the end, this is a social problem. And this is what I want to end with. This Jack Goldsmith, law professor at Harvard, I was talking to him about this. And one of the things he said was that if you ask for more congressional oversight, what you will get is a more permissive NSA. What he's basically saying is, as long as Congress is scared, they're not going to put limits on this. That major social change has to happen, that we have to get over our fear. We need to, you know, that's on the government side. On the corporate side, we need to value privacy. As long as we don't value privacy, we're going to be happily tell Facebook everything about our lives because it's convenient. And those two social changes bring about, if we make those changes, everything else is easy. You don't make those changes, everything else is impossible. And there's a fundamental issue here, and this will be my final point. We have to figure out how to design systems that benefit society as a whole while at the same time protecting people individually. I think this is the fundamental issue of the information age. Our data has enormous value to us collectively and has enormous value to us individually. How do we extract both? Right? Data in the group interest, data in self-interest. The societal benefits of big data, the individual risks of big data. And there are lots of manifestations of this problem. Surveillance is just one of them. I mean, you could disagree with the efficacy, and I certainly do, but the basic bargain you're being offered by the NSA is, tell me everything and I will keep you safe. That's the bargain. The bargain in behavioral advertising is, tell me everything and I will show you ads you actually want to see. I think of the same question in medical data. There is enormous value in taking all of our medical data, putting it in one giant database, and letting researchers at it. It's incredibly valuable to us as a species. Yet that data is incredibly personal. I know a researcher at Purdue, his name is Ray Junko. He does work in student and in student study habits. And he uses surveillance to monitor students reading textbooks. I didn't know this, that a lot of textbooks now are available online, and you can monitor students, how often they open the textbooks, what they read, how fast they read, what they highlight, what they go back and reread. And you can take all of that data, correlate it with grades, and figure out what is an effective way for students to engage with textbooks. Junko has done that. He has produced a series of interventions and tools and tricks to help students study better and learn better. Really great research, but incredibly invasive. Now, he balances that by having the students know they're part of an experiment, and really he doesn't need everybody's data, he just needs a sample. But it's the same deal. Our movement data. When I got here, my Uber used the Google directions, and we were able to see real-time traffic data on how the roads were clogged. That data is surveillance data. Right? That's because everyone using Google Maps sends back to Google how fast they're going. And Google can give us very valuable information. Right? So getting there faster, Google knows where you are at all times. This is it. This is the question. We have to design systems to deal with both of those poles. Thank you very much.